Shalom Aleichem, dear friends. It's a pleasure to be back on Headlines. Thank you, Reb David, for this opportunity. We'll be speaking about being frum in politics. What does it mean to be a frum politician? How do you hold a job that is known for manipulating the truth, breaking promises, and conniving tactics? How do you make a Kiddush Hashem in the halls of power? What do you do when voting in security cabinets on decisions whether to go to war or approve an operation? What are you supposed to have in mind? And as I had the opportunity, the schus of davening once again in Dominion, the epicenter of the pandemic here in New York City, and thinking that it's not by chance that this week's parsha is the parsha of the Meraglim. And if you know the source of Ein Dover Shebekdusha Pachos Me'asara, that you need a minion of 10, is the Gemara in Megillah, V'nigdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael, kol dover shebekdusha lo yeh pachos me'asara, anything that is holiness shouldn't be less than asara, my mashma, tan rabchia toich toich, v'nigdashti b'soch b'nei Yisrael, hibadlu mitocha eida, we learn eida eida, ad masai la eida haro azos, ma lehalon asara, afkan asara. We learn the source of the obligation to daven with the minion from the Meraglim. And why would you learn the most positive, uplifting opportunity, experience of davening with a minion from the failed group of people who were definitely did not succeed in the mission of coming back and inspiring the Jewish people to go to Eretz Yisrael? Why is this a source? It comes to show you the power of 10 people, the power of Jewish leadership. You know, one of the most famous psukim in the Torah, "V'nehi be'einenu kechagavim v'chein ha'inu be'einem." We were like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and this is how we were in theirs. You know, are we seeing ourselves as grasshoppers? It's true that before the war, the Panovich Rav was a member of the Lithuanian parliament. Reb Meir Shapir of Lublin was a member of the Polish Sejm. But I don't think that we've had as many people who are yeshiva students, as many women who wear shetels, serve as ministers in the government of the State of Israel, responsible for deciding of approving operations in the West Bank and Gaza, overseeing ministries with billions of shekels and dollars under their auspices. I don't think there's ever a situation where you're able to have a shtiblach in the Knesset and multiple dafyomi shurim. Many, many frum people are in positions of power in Israel. The attorney general, the head of the Mossad, the former head of the police, again, senior ministers and cabinet ministers as well. So we have the opportunity, before we go on to our program, is to hear a special Dvar Torah from Reb David Lichtenstein on the Parsha. And then I'll introduce the guests.
Thank you, Rabbi Goldschmidt, for this week's program, giving me some time off. How often have you been asked, what are those strings hanging out of your pants? You know, most irreligious, those who are, you know, non-Jews, have no understanding of what it is. In fact, many frumer people don't know what tzitzis represent. So this week, in fact, somebody came over, we social distance, a neighbor who's, you know, a friar neighbor. And again, he was asking me about the tzitzis. He came to tell me about all his tzaris with his business, if I could give him an etzah. So I said to him, let me tell you the secret of the tzitzis. You know, nobody likes, you know, being put in a corner. Nobody likes being doing things against their will. We like freedom, optionality. When we get trapped, we get anxiety, frustrated. I mean, who's not frustrated today if you're running a business or if you have to go to yeshiva and you can't have a chavrusa, you're sitting, you know, you're stuck at home? You know, we get depressed. You know, frustration leads to depression, is a silent temper tantrum. So stuck in a corner with nowhere to go is difficult emotionally, right? What does the Torah talk about this week's parsha? Corners. V'asulam tzitzis al kanfei bigdechem, on the corners of your clothing. Tzitzis are called arba kanfeis, four corners. And why are there four corners? We get cornered four times in our life in four situations. We could get cornered in ruchnius. You're stuck. You know, you can't seem to get things going. There's no shuls, no chavrusis. You're not davening well. You're not learning well. We could get cornered in health. weight, you know, blood pressure, all the different diseases that people, Rahman Olzvan, have, we could get cornered in relationships. We've all had those experiences. We could get cornered in business. A lot of people today, look, you know, we were facing 20%, the worst unemployment since the Great Depression. So many industries, notwithstanding the stock market, are just flat out. So we're cornered. Now, what do a lot of people do in a corner? You know, use of antidepressants is off the charts. People often curl into like a fetal ball. They get scared. They get, you know, they shrink. What is it called? There's tefach atzuvos and tefach soichakos. Atzuvos means that they're tight. They get clamped. You withdraw into yourself. But there's a different way. The Torah tells us a Jewish way. Rashi says, why are they called tzitzis? He says, tupshat them, I think they're one. Rashi says they're either threads, psilim, fringes, threads. Or he says it comes from vision. Meitzitz min acharakim. To examine, to look very carefully. What's the message of the tzitzis? You're stuck in a corner. Am I just going to put my head down, lock myself in a room, right? Do whatever I can, pull out a book, a thing to get internet addicted? Or am I going to look outward? Because very often when we're cornered, if we would keep our eyes open, there is some opportunity. You know, there's always some dre you could do. Can you look, meitzitz, beyond the corners? The Jewish way is, hakol b'cheskas sumin, ad shehakadosh baruch hu meir eseinayim. There's always some idea. You know, it says by Hagar, she was left with her child, she had limited provisions, and she ran out of provision, she ran out of water in the desert. So it said, she threw her child, tachas achad, she didn't want to see b'mois hayelid. She was at wit's end. And what happened? The Rabbeinu Shalom came. It says, "Vayifkach Elokim Eseinah." He opened up her eyes. "Vatera Be'er Mayim." It doesn't say he created a Be'er Mayim. It seems the Be'er was always there. But you know what? When we're scared, when we're preoccupied, a lot of times the Be'er that's right in front of us, we just can't see it. Right? So what's the secret of tzitzis? To look beyond the envelope. Look beyond the corner. Find that thread out of the corner. And you know, it's interesting. Everybody knows that chatnas, klayim, is an isser in the whole Torah. The Torah wants boundaries. There's tzemer, there's pishtim. Respect, there's a father, there's a son. Boundaries. Klayim by tzitzis is mutter. In other words, when you're stuck in a corner, you want to get out of your envelope. You have to break some boundaries. To make an omelet, you got to break some eggs. You got to go beyond your comfort zone. You got to go into shatnas. And it's interesting. The parsha of tzitzis is directly juxtaposed to the parsha of the mekayshish etzim. What is the mekayshish etzim? He chopped wood. There's nothing that's more repetitive than wood chopping. In fact, when we want to say what somebody does in a derogatory way, we say he's a wood chopper. Same motion, million times in a row. Chop, 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 chop. So the Torah is telling us there's two mahalchim. Albert Einstein, a Jew, once said, there's no surer sign of lunacy or idiocy than repeatedly doing the same thing but expecting a different outcome. That's the mekayshish etzim. That's one mahalach. And the other mahalach is, you're stuck in a corner, vasulam tzitzis. Look beyond. Find that thread. And then it says even more. The Torah gives us further advice. It says, "V'nosnu al tzitzis hakanaf." This thread that's coming out of the corner, maybe I should just look 1 inch beyond the corner. Put one psil, according to the Rambam. It's one psil, Raivit, two, Rash, three, Taisus. But let's say one psil. Psil tcheles, one of blue. And what does blue represent? So Achrayim say, when the eye, the furthest the eye could see is blue. The heaven really has no color. But the farthest you could see is blue. In other words, you want to get out of the corner. You're just looking for the slightest thread. But keep one eye open. Maybe there's a home run out there. Don't give up on that dream. Yeah, we want to get out. But also, once we break out, who knows? Maybe we can go as far as we can see. Heard a story. The Emir of Qatar, of Qatar, it's an Arabic country, it's floating on oil. Guy's got more money than anybody in the world. And he was a golf fanatic. But there's nothing, there's no golf courses. It's a barren desert, arid desert. He hired one of the world's great golf architects to come out there to design a golf course, a contract, negotiated, millions of dollars. The architect flies out there, gets off the plane. It's 120 degrees in Qatar. Qatar, different ways to pronounce it. So what does this architect do? He goes to this emir, the sultan, and he says, listen, I know I signed the contract. There's no way I'm sticking around in 120 degree weather. So this emir betzach bayem, he says, listen, I know for you it's just a few months. I'm stuck here my whole life. I'm a golf fanatic. There's not a blade of grass here. There's nothing to do. Ich betzach b'matus aminach. Please build the golf course like you signed. So the guy said, I'll try it for a month. He comes back a month later. He's mamish eingebacht. He says, there hasn't been one day under 110 degrees. I can't do it. The emir pleads with him again. Kids, the guy sticks it out. 6 months, finishes it. The emir comes out, plays his first round, and he's besimcha rabba. He's overwhelmed with joy. A golf course, a gorgeous golf course. Turns to the architect. He says, I know I paid you millions, your firm, but I want to give you another gift just for my thanks. What would you like? This architect says, I don't know. I have everything I need. You know what? Give me a new set of golf clubs. Some more golf clubs. The emir looks at him and he says, okay. The guy goes home, tells his wife, I'm probably going to get these gold or gold-plated golf clubs with rubies. Waits a month, 2 months, nothing happens, forgets about it. 6 months later, a FedEx comes in the mail from the emir of Qatar. He opens it up and there's a handwritten letter. You know, he writes, dear architect, he says, it took me a while. You asked for golf clubs. I couldn't find, there was really quality golf clubs. I just couldn't find any for sale. It took me 6 months to put together a real nice set, enclosed. Thank you. He opens up his envelope. They pulls, he says, golf. He opens it up. The first one is a deed to a golf club in Florida. Beautiful golf club. The second one is the deed to a golf club in Washington State. The third, near Seattle. The third one is a golf club in New Jersey. Three premier golf clubs. This guy wanted a golf club, a shtekin, to get a hack. The other guy heard golf club. He meant the golf club with, you know, 18 holes, you know, rolling greens. What does psil tcheles mean? You're in the corner. The Torah is giving you an etzah. Keep your head up. Keep looking. Look for the way out. It's the Jewish way, the opportunity, the dray, right? Shatnez, break some things. But don't just try to get out. Keep one eye out. Who knows? Maybe you'll get lucky. So I told this fellow who came over to me, he's a religious fellow, doesn't know anything. I told him what tzitzis represent. He was telling me about how he's struggling. I said, he looked at me, he said, where can I get a pair of those fringes, he tells me. I said, tzitzis. He says, where can I buy a pair of those fringes? So now more than ever, this parsha is so relevant during COVID. It's going to be with us for a while, maybe a year till they have a vaccine. Businesses are going to struggle. Livelihoods will struggle. It's going to be a tough year. So when you put on your tzitzis in the morning and you make the bracha, al mitzvas tzitzis, remember the message of the tzitzis. Keep your head up. It's the Jewish way. Keep looking for options. Look for that thread. Keep your vision. With Rabbeinu Shalom's help, we will see a way out of this. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
So as we spoke about that we're going to be speaking to senior politicians, I try to bring a broad tapestry from politicians in Israel. The first one is Eli Groner. Eli Groner is the general director of the Prime Minister's office, Bibi Netanyahu, from 2015 to 2018. Now he's represents the Coke industries in Israel. Eli Groner also, he speaks English. Obviously, all the interviewees today, I had to find the English speakers among them. You know, is probably similar to the chief of staff of the White House, responsible for the operations of the Prime Minister of Israel. How do you keep Shmir Shabbos? How do you tell the Prime Minister your MIA for Shabbos's An Yamim Tovim? What do you think is the relationship? It's a very close relationship between Bibi and the Haredi parties. What does he think about this relationship? Is it a real partnership? Or perhaps it is just out of political necessity? Our next guest is M.K. Rav Yitzchak Pindrus, from just joined in the Knesset today, former acting mayor of Jerusalem and mayor of Beitar, a very talented person as well, discussing regarding the leadership of Gedolei Yisrael, whether is it the leadership of Reb Chaim Kanievsky, Reb Gershon Edelstein. and also about the shift in Haredi Hashkafa. You know, Haredim were extremely anti-Zionist to begin with a century ago. And the Aguda sort of slowly but slowly changed many positions with regards to taking positions and holding positions in the secular Israeli government. First, they did not participate in any elections to the Vad HaLeumi, to the Knesset, before even the state was established. Then they said, you know what, we'll participate in the voting, but we won't participate in the government. Then they said, we'll participate in the government, but we will not be ministers. And now, the last few years, you have Haredi ministers. So it's extremely, our Haredim in Israel have become Haredi Zionists. How can they say that they're not full-fledged members of, because they're basically in many leadership positions in the country. We'll have a fascinating conversation with him as well. The third one is Minister Zev Elkin. He's one of the most talented and trustworthy ministers to the Prime Minister. He's a Baal Tshuva, originally from the former Soviet Union. He almost got a PhD in Rav Saadia Gaon. He learned for 5 years in yeshiva in Har Tzion. He served in many different ministries. He's the Minister of Higher Education and Water Resources. He's a cabinet minister. But also, he's a member of the Likud party. Why do many from people choose to serve in secular parties? Where does he think from people will have more influence? Are we supposed to have sectorial parties or not? And then also, his personal experiences. Some of those important meetings that happen is between Bibi Netanyahu and President Vladimir Putin of Russia regarding operations in Syria. And obviously Bibi doesn't speak Russian and Putin doesn't speak Hebrew. So the translator that Bibi trusts is Zev Elkin. So some of the most important conversations happening in the world, he is the person translating between Bibi Netanyahu and Vladimir Putin. And when does he go to ask Rabbanim Shilas? What decisions he decides to make on his own? This conversation, it does not have as many, I didn't speak to Rabbanim about their view of how should politicians act. In this, which is very important on its own as well, but in this program, we will try to focus to hear their experiences. The people, as they say, with boots on the ground. How do they operate? How do they feel their mission in the halls of power? And how do they feel is the best way to do a Kiddush Hashem? Orthodox Jews, are we ready to be in positions of power? Are we ready to understand that the Eidah could also create Dvarim Shebekdusha? We could create Minyanim. We could create and have great power as well. But power is not just a privilege. It's mainly a responsibility. Thank you very much for joining me, and I hope you enjoy.
We have a very special guest today to speak to. His name is Harav Yitzchak Pindrus. He's the former mayor of Beitar, deputy and acting mayor of Yerushalayim, and the chair of the general secretary of the Degla Torah party, and going into serve as a Knesset member starting this Sunday. Rabbi Pindrus, Shalom Aleichem. How are you?
Baruch Hashem. Good evening from Yerushalayim.
Thank you very much. Mazel Tov. Do you get a Mazel Tov for going to Knesset, or you get a Baruch Dynamis for going into Knesset? Is it a Pesayra Tov or a Pesayra Ra?
If you could, the Masichei Kavucha, Masichei Achkucha, if we'll succeed to make a Kiddush Hashem and to bring to Ela Matera a better future, so it's a Pesayra Tov. If we'll fail, so it's a Pesayra Ra.
So you're saying I should give you a mazel tov al tnai?
It's al tnai.
But it's
a difficult. And there's no doubt. It's a difficult shlichus. Of course, now the crisis in the whole world, and of course, when Israel is divided between the religious and not religious, and a very deep. We have to three elections that a big part of those elections were around the religion and state. So we're going into a difficult mission, and we hope we'll succeed.
Amen. The Haredi Knesset members are called Shlucho Derabanan, the messengers of the Gdolim. So Chazaka Shliach Oseh Shlichuto. I'm sure you will be, in Mirz Hashem, you'll be successful with your shlichus. Could I ask you first a personal question? Where's your English from? I think you're one of only two Knesset members out of 17, 18 Haredi Knesset members who speaks English. Where's it from?
My parents came from America. My father was born in Cleveland. My mother was from Boston. I was born in Eretz Yisrael and grew up in Eretz Yisrael, but picked it up from the home.
You picked it up from home. Okay, excellent. Could I ask you, what are the biggest challenges of being a from politician?
I would put the three main challenges, okay? The three main things that we have to do and three main missions we have, and those are basically the challenges. One is to make sure that the from community in Eretz Yisrael, okay, should get the regular rights that every resident gets, which is not something that's natural, of course, not in Israel, because Israel, as we know, was established the Zionist movement in the early, I would say, you know, about 100 years ago, was basically supposed to be instead of being religious. So there was this fight has been going on for 100 years. So they tried to take the education out of a legal process. They try to take every rights that a from Jew needs in Eretz Yisrael has to be fought for. That's the first mission. The second mission is Kiddush Hashem. And when I say Kiddush Hashem is in one way is very bad. You have to be the Kaddish Shemayim because you know your ambassador, a Torah ambassador. Like you said, our board, okay, and our owners of our company, our Gdol Yisrael, right? So who's the official board of Gdol Torah, Gdol Yisrael? Our Meretz is Gdol Torah. They're the people that have the right to sign. They're the people that have the right. They own the party. And it's not that we go and consult with them or ask them. No, they own the party. We're their shlichim. So being their shlichim is mechayev to act different. But not only that. Every Chilul Shabbos in a Jewish state, every the Treifas and Avelis and everything like that is a Chilul Hashem. When you have a Jewish state, you have Jews that being Chal Shabbos in public, okay? A Jewish state is Chal Shabbos officially. And you're part of it is a Chash Chil Hashem. So that's the second challenge, to see how to stop that as much as you can, okay? There's no 100%, that's for sure, but as much as you can, it should be Chil Hashem. That's the second challenge. The third challenge is a challenge that every representer has, okay? That the country should function. When the country functions, you know, when there's roads that people could drive in, so from people drive and non-from people drive, Jews drive and non-Jews drive over there. But everybody needs, by the end of the day, there should be roads, there should be public transportation, there should be, you know, the economy should work, the whole country should work. So you have that, that's a regular challenge in every politician. And then you have the first two main challenges, which their challenges are known.
Can I ask you, I would like to discuss all three of them with you, if you would be kind enough. Let's start with Chil Hashem and Kiddush Hashem. It's fair to say that for many non-from Jews, what they know about religious Jews, especially in Israel, is from the religious and Haredi politicians. How do you think Haredi politicians are representing the Olam HaTorah in the eyes of the general public?
Like they represent, like I said, there's two parts to it, okay? One part is that we have to explain that the most important thing we have is the yeshivas, the most important thing we have is people sitting and learning. And that is difficult to explain to a secular person that then doesn't remember that he and his grandparents were in Har Sinai, right? It's not easy, but that's one part that we have to explain. But that already, I could say, in generally, people could hear, okay, you have priorities that are different than our priorities, and that's one part of it. When you're talking about Chilul Shabbos and things like that, the main question that a secular person asks is, why are you mixing into my life, right? You're living in a democracy. I want to have public transportation on Shabbos. Why is it your business? I want to have it even in my town. I agree that I won't have it in an Orthodox town, but I think in one word, okay, we'll go through that every day, but in one word is the only right that we have to be here in the Middle East. When, like I said at the beginning, when your first question you asked me is, my father came from Cleveland, my mother from Boston, right? So what right do I have to live over here? the only right I have to live over here is because HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised this place to the Jewish nation, and he promised this to the Jewish nation, and he put terms in it, and he said if you'll keep it there or not. You can't come and claim that you own the land, and the Palestinians that are here for generations or for years, the Arabs that are here, don't own the land because you were promised the land. The whole Zionist idea doesn't even have any excuse to be here if you don't keep the Torah. That's something that we have to say it again and again. I can't tell you that everybody likes to hear that, but that's something that we say it again and again.
How do you think, and, how successful has this answer been in the last few decades in winning over friends?
The success of stopping Chilulei Shabbos is not by convincing. The success of stopping Nevelus Atreifus is not by convincing, it's by political power, okay? By using coalitions, I mean, that's no doubt. And I'm not naive. I don't think that if I sit in front of a secular politician or a secular doctor, I convinced him. And by any case, even I convinced him, he represents, you know, he represents 100,000 voters that they have to convince each and every one of them. We have to say it very loud and use political tools, I mean, to get those ideas to happen and to be. I don't think that we can convince, but we have to do it in a chumadika way. We have to do it in a way that does Kiddush and Shabbat, right? Not in a way that makes a chil Hashem, but we have to do it in a political way. But we have to say it very loud and very clear.
Rabbi Pinders, could I ask you a question? You know, today in politics, there's a concept that's very popular. People say, speak to your base. Many leaders choose to speak to their base, to rile up your base. Don't try to convince anyone else. Try to rile up your own chever. Could I ask you personally, when you're going to speak in the Knesset on Sunday, what do you care about more? Are you speaking to the guy who's going to tell you a Yisur Koyach after Minyan and Shacharis? Or you're speaking about a secular soldier in an army base in the north? Who are you talking to? I'm sure you're going to say both.
No.
But
we have a privilege that most politicians don't have. Because we're Shlichim of Gdil Yisrael, and because we're a party, like I said, that are owned by Gdil Yisrael, I don't mean Shlichim, right? They're owned by Gdil Yisrael. We don't have to be busy speaking to our base. We're not busy doing our primaries, and we're not busy going around our base. That's not what we're busy about. When we're talking about Chilulei Shabbos, or we're talking about Kashrus, which was the second thing I spoke about before, we're talking outside. We're caring about Klal Yisrael. Because if I'm talking to my base, a person says, okay, in my area, in my backyard, nobody's driving on Shabbos. I don't use public transportation in Shabbos. What do I care that in the middle of Tel Aviv, in a secular area, there's buses? Okay, we're not talking at all if we're talking about these issues to our base. We do relate to our base, and again, not because of primaries, because that's one of our missions, is to make sure that they have rights, that they have school systems, they have yeshivas, they have shuls, okay, they have roads. Over there, we have to serve our base, but it's easier for us. We don't have to get up every morning and check what the polls are and what are people thinking in the shtiblach and what are people thinking in the mikveh. We don't have to do that. We have the privilege not to do it, okay? So we could go straight with the Asterah and know what we could compromise on, what we can't compromise on, what are things that we have to fight and say, okay, this is our... we can't go down more than that. And what are things that we say, no way, that's what we're going to do? These are things that we could ask Bill Israel. We're less busy than secular politicians that need their polls and their headlines at their next day.
You know, you mentioned in the beginning, you spoke about secular Zionism from 100 years ago, which is very interesting. And that, until this very day, whenever it comes to Shabbos and yeshiva boys and other different things that are extremely important to the Haredi party, you said it's been a century-long struggle. Can I ask you a question? You know, it seems to be that the Aguda is changing its hashkafa over the last century. 100 years ago, the Aguda did not participate in the beginning. It was together with the Eidah Haredis. They did not participate to the Vada Leumi elections at all. when the state was founded a couple of years later, they said, you know what, you could participate in the elections, but not in the government. Then they joined the government, but said, we're not going to be ministers. We're just going to be vice ministers. And now for the last few years, we have the Minister of Health, and now the Minister of Housing is Minister Litzman. So it sounds like, the Ashkafa has been changing dramatically. And now it sounds like, the Haredim are senior partners in the government. So why has the Ashkafa changed?
I don't feel that Ashkafa changed, okay? I don't feel that Ashkafa changed. It's just like asking why in the Six-Day War you use these type of missiles and why today you're using different type of missiles, that the army strategy changed. We're talking about a battle, okay? And the battle is a complicated battle. On one hand, we love Eretz Yisrael more than any Zionist you could think about, the secular Jew, okay? We say Yerushalayim Derecha three times a day. We say the Sechazer Ereinu three times a day. We grew up, okay? We learned Chumash Dvarim, that every page has five times a reminder that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings us to Eretz Yisrael. We read in Tanakh what HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings us to Eretz Yisrael, on one hand. On the second hand, okay, we're not disagreeing. We think it's the most dangerous thing that we should become a nation, okay, through having a state and not becoming a nation through the terror. Not the state made us into a nation, okay? And not to get confused with that, so when the Zionist movement was strong enough and big enough, and there was a danger like that, so the Klei Milchama, the way to fight it, was in one way. Okay? So if people could get confused and say, if you're part of the Zionist movement, so you probably believe in part of the ideas and part you don't believe. And then you have a problem. What do you do with Leman Asher Tzavez Bonavaz Beisachav? How do you explain to your children where are they wrong? Okay, and that was the main battle, like you said before, 100 years ago. After the state was started, it was a question of democracy. You're part of you live here, okay? You live here if you like it or not. They're the state, they're ruling the state. Today, you're talking about a community, and just to get the idea, in 1948, the Haredi community in Eretz Yisrael were 2% of the population. Today, they're 12, 14% of the population. When you're 12, 14% of the population, your position changes, your ways of fighting it changes, okay? And in the world, the words of democracy, the way of people acting to things are changing. So the way the Dark Amichom are changing. Now, who decides the Dark Amichom? Our generals, the Gdol Yisrael, they could tell us, listen, now you have to fight with airplanes, now you have to fight with these type of missiles, and now you have to fight with this type of war. I mean, the Dark Amichom, how they change. You know, there's no Aloch and Shulchan Aruch, don't be a minister. There's no Aloch and Shulchan Aruch, do not be the finance minister, but be the health minister. It's where Gdol Yisrael could tell you what are the ways of fighting the battle you have. Today we're talking about, just to understand, if what I said with 12% Haredim in Eretz Yisrael, today the majority of the secular people in Eretz Yisrael are a lot more traditional. You see it in the elections. If you wouldn't have the 20% Arabs, okay, so the left wing in Eretz Yisrael will be less than 30%. I'm reminding you, all of us in 1948, okay, labor was probably 80% of this country. Labor and the communists and a couple more and merits of these people, they were 80% of the country. Today, they're 30%. If I don't count the Arabs, they're only 30% left. That means that 70% of the Jewish population, in a certain way, okay, Ish and Dargosa, each one in his level, believes in the ideas that we're talking about now, okay? That the Jewish nation is a nation by the Torah, that the Jewish nation, that Shabbos is a day that we got as a present, and it's not something that's falling in us. But we're still finding the 30%, and those 30% are using the Arabs on their side because of different reasons, okay? The Arabs are doing it because of different reasons, because they want us kicked out of here. But it has nothing to do with that, so you see a change. So when that changes, when you're fighting 90%, fighting 30%, the ways of fighting it are different.
I just want to, one of my friends told me, and I want to hear your opinion. He told me today the Haredim in Israel, they're Zionist Haredim, because you're the leadership, you're telling them about the 30%. Haredim are considered the Shutafim HaTivim, the natural partners of Benjamin Netanyahu, who's the most powerful political leader Israel has had in the last 40 years. You're at his side. You're closer to him than perhaps members of his own party. So how could you are partners of leadership of the Zionist entity? So the Shaila
is... First of all, I don't understand the question. The first Zionist movement was the Talmidei HaBaal Shem Tov and Talmidei HaGro that came to Eretz Yisrael 100 years before Herzl was born. Okay? But that's first of all. We were a lot more Oyev Eretz Yisrael than all these people before all these guys knew where Eretz Yisrael is and what Eretz Yisrael is. And their grandparents were still very from. Okay? So that let's start with that. The reason we're partners, and now you're saying something else, the reason we're partners with Netanyahu is... concluding what I was saying before. Netanyahu represents, forget Netanyahu as a person. Netanyahu represents, okay, the traditional people in Eretz Yisrael. People that do believe in Yiddishkeit and religious ideas on their level. I'm not saying they're not, okay, they don't, they're not medagdic in every Siddur Shulchan Aruch, but they believe in that idea, and that's why we're a lot closer to them. The reason
we're also not, we're also
changed. The first time that Meretz Yisrael agreed that Agudas Yisrael should get in the coalition was in 77 when Begin became prime minister. Why? Because Begin was closer to Yiddishkeit than the people that were there before him, okay? Than Levi Eshkol and the Labor Party. The Likud represents the people that are a lot more traditional and a lot more... That's the reason we're partners. It's not Benjamin Netanyahu. It could be anyone else over there, it's the same idea. It's the idea of who you're representing. Yeah, we want to be, we're a lot closer to those 70% that I spoke before than those 30% that are sitting in Tel Aviv and want Eretz Israel to look like Paris, like Paris.
So one second, you're saying that the relationship with Bibi Netanyahu is Ava Tluya Badover or Ava Shaima Tluya Badover?
You're talking about, yeah, it's the idea. It's not even the person.
I hear. I want to ask you a question. You spoke about, you know, many people have asked, have thought recently that the leadership of the Haredi party of Degel HaTorah is Reb Chaim Kanievsky. And people are saying recently that there's been a change that now the leader of the party is Reb Gershon Edelstein, the Reshiva of Panovich. Is that true?
The leaders of Degel HaTorah are Reb Chaim and Reb Gershon. Both of them are doing it together. Yad B'Yad, since Reb Shteina passed away, everything is done al Dasler to Degel HaTorah, and of course the two leaders, Reb Chaim and Reb Gershon. No decision is made without asking them. No move is made without asking them. And I got into the Knesset because it was their decision to bring me in. It's made by Reb Chaim and Reb Gershon, every move that's done in the Rotter.
I hear. Also, right now, the decision of who the politician should be representing the Haredi world is chosen by Gdol Yisrael. Is that correct?
Yeah, the chosen only by Gdol Yisrael. It's also officially, legally, who could sign on the list, okay? Who, and the Republicans make the primaries, right? The Democrats make the primaries. The Likud makes they have their primaries. Over here, who signs, who votes? Officially on the papers, signed there to Gdol HaTorah.
Could I ask you a question? What if people say, you know, the Gemara in Brachas Daf Nun Hei says, Why shouldn't there be a primaries in Haredi parties? Obviously, the Gdol HaTorah should decide who's in the Parsha, who's not. But perhaps it should be also the Tzibur should be able to decide who should be the Parnassim. What are your thoughts about that?
First of all, you know, I'm new, so I could be made on my friends that are dear and so now. I'm no doubt, and we see it also by what's happening, is that Gdol Yisrael, that's what they do. They're looking for people that are Merutzim Lakol. They don't get up in the morning and put a person and say, let's go. Okay? They find out who the people are. They're Merutzim Lakol. Ain't no Merutzim Lakol. It doesn't say primaries. It says Merutzim Lakol. That's how people are elected. Nobody puts someone brings him out from nowhere and says, well, go to the Knesset. They know who the people are, who that's Kodi Mark. They know what they do. And like I said before, we're not talking, it's not a Parnas or a Tzibur. We're talking about running a battle and a war. And when a war, nobody elects, okay, the general in the army, right? Nobody elects a general in the army, right? You appoint a general in the army because you're talking about a battle and a war. A battle and war doesn't go through the primaries. And we are in a war over here. Maybe people forget it because what you said before, because today we take ministers and the dark and the war changes the ways of it, but we are in a war. We are in a battle. We're in a battle of the future of our children. We're in a battle of the future of the Eretz Yisrael. We are in a battle of the future of Shabbos and Eretz Yisrael, of Kashrus and Eretz Yisrael, of Gerus and Eretz Yisrael. We're in a battle on all these things.
And who would you say is the most dangerous person when it comes to fighting for religious things in the Israeli politics today?
Today, for a long time, it was Lapid. Today, Lieberman is giving him a strong hug and helping him out there. But there's a lot of people. I mean, we could talk about the mayor of Tel Aviv. We could talk about the mayor of Goy. It's not one single person. Just like the other side is not one single person. We're talking about almost, like I said before, almost 30% of the population that think that the Jewish nation has to be Kechol Ha'am.
Before we wrap up, I just want to ask you two more questions. It's extremely, many polls have said that Bibi Netanyahu is extremely popular in the Haredi world. Why do you think he's so popular within the Frum world?
First of all, like I said, we're partners with the Likud party for years for the reasons I said before. Second of all, there's a natural feeling of that everybody's after him, just like they're after the Frum community. And that the part of the ways that they fight with us, like I said before, we fight our battle. Part of the ways that they fight with us is through the legal positions of the of judges, of the courts, of police, of things like that. And we feel they're using the same the tools that they fight with us to fight with what he represents and what he's doing. And that natural feeling gives us a feeling of being with him and liking him.
You don't think it's his charisma, it's the sense of pride and his accomplishment?
No doubt he accomplished a lot. But he asked why the Frum community more than any other community, so that's the reason. Of course, when Netanyahu succeeded and had Siyata Dishmaya that no one even dreamt there. Just take an example how he stood in front of Obama when Obama was trying to stop building in Eretz Yisrael and, of course, in Jerusalem and the West Bank. How he stood in front of the whole world. How the businesses in Israel are doing very well. Okay, the whole financial issue in Israel is doing very well, and people feel that he's doing a good job, and he's very, very succeeded very much in the last 10 years. And like I said before, and that's the feeling why they're trying to get rid of him, because they feel that he's succeeding too much. In Israel, I said on upper deck that they hate Netanyahu more than anyone else because he talks like someone from Tel Aviv and he represents Jerusalem.
Reb Yitzchak, I want to ask you two more questions before we conclude. My first question is, how hard has coronavirus hit the Haredi world and the religious world? Besides, it's hit hard throughout Israel. And you said when it comes to issues of building roads, you don't just work for the people who voted for you, you vote for everyone in Israel. So could tell me in two words, what's on your agenda in terms of getting out of this huge crisis?
First of all, there's a big Siyata Dishmaya and a big Nes in Eretz Yisrael in general. We hear what's going on in the rest of the world. We hear what's going on all around the world, the Yiddish world even, and in Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem. We're talking about maybe 300 people that passed away from the corona, which is terrible, but still, it's comparing what's going on in the world is very low. We're talking today about between 3,000 and 3,500 people all around Eretz Yisrael that have it all, the disease. We're talking only about 26 or 27 people tonight that are need help in breathing. So we think that we feel the Eretz Asherein Elokecha Bomeration Sashonu Vadach Rishonu. So generally, outside both the businesses were closed and people that lost money, but in general, Eretz Yisrael went through it very, very, with big siyat and shmai in the beginning. And in Anachma speaking, and we're ready to see what's going to work out.
But in terms of how do you get out of the financial rut? More than a million Israelis lost their jobs.
Most of the things in Israel are already open. People have to go out with the mask, have to be more careful. Even Hasidus were led this week already to do up to 250 people in the hall. So things in Israel are getting slow by slow. The yeshivas were open part-time, but they're open. There's a whole issue of having classes that people go into the yeshiva and they're there for a month and a half and not leaving, which helped very much. And it worked at least on 30-40% of the yeshiva gvoris.
You know, they say that the
mashgichim. It looks like we're getting out of it slow by slow.
They say the mashgichim and the yeshivas are very happy. They want to lock up the bachrim for the next 5 years, never to leave yeshiva. To make sure they sit and learn the Beis Medrash.
I'm not sure about that because the mashgich has also locked up with them, so I'm not sure about that.
Listen, it's a labor of love. Before we go, we would appreciate so much if you could share a personal behind-the-scenes story of either a halachic shaila or a question you asked your Chaim Kanievsky or Gershon Edelstein that you did not know how to resolve within your work in the Knesset, in local government, in Jerusalem. If you could share something with us, we would really appreciate it.
First of all, shaylas that are now going up, we are very careful not to share what's talking inside the rooms, but I could tell you what happened in the past in Yerushalayim. I could tell you the Knesset, that was the Yid, I could tell you what I was in Yerushalayim. And we used to ask Rav Yashin, it was unbelievable, his look and his nituach, every time he walked at them, and you thought you know what's going on, and he used to open your eyes and show you you didn't even think about it. Okay, I even remember once Barakat came up to me and asked me if opening a parking lot on Shabbos, if he could do it or not, because people are parking anyhow, they're going in, he's not going for Chil Shabbos. He had a whole love this. I went up there, Rav Yashu told me, what options do you have? So I said, they answered yes or no. He says, you have another option, don't even answer it. And I said, why not answer it? He's not going to listen to you anyhow. And I went out and I didn't answer. There was another representative that he came up to with the same shaila. He asked him,
I didn't understand. What was the question and what is the option? I'm sorry, I missed it.
He claimed that because people park on the streets, it's a pikuach nefesh, and the people are there anyhow with the cars, so let's just open a parking lot.
Is this the parking lot in Rehov HaGron, right next to those?
Yeah, right, the parking lot in Rehov HaGron. And I walked to the Riyashu, and I asked him, what should I answer? And the Riyashu told me, you're not answering. I said, he's asking, he says he's not going to listen to you anyhow. Just ignore the question. And when he opened it, the reaction said to everybody out to demonstrate. It wasn't that he was that. He didn't think I would just make yourself don't feel about it. He said, anyhow, not going to that. You just started with him. I'm going to get into he's not going to listen to you. And so I'm going to go on. And there was another guy, a friend of mine, a colleague of mine, that went and told him, don't you dare open it. And of course, like what Liasha told me, he didn't listen. And the end was that they had to demonstrate. There were big demonstrations all around Yerushalayim. But they see it without any gears. They see it without any side things, okay? They don't have the death. They look at the Shulchan Aruch. They look at the Gemara. They look at the Das Torah. They tell you what you have to do.
Could I ask you, they say, my father always told me, what's the difference between a diplomat and a politician? A diplomat lies for his country. A politician lies to his country. Can I ask you, is being a politician a job for a good from boy, a good Jewish boy? Perhaps, you know, the Torah says, Midvar Sheker Tichak, distance yourself from lies. What do you have to say about it? You know, it's not an easy line of work. They say being a rabbi is not a job for a nice Jewish boy. What do you think about that?
I'll tell you, the differences between a shlucha de rabbanon and a politician, and that there has to be, and I hope after going into the Knesset it's not going to change, is you go in and you know what your goals are. You're not going in to be a politician. You're not going in to be a minister. You're not going in to be to do something for yourself. You're going in and you have a clear mission, like I said before, the three missions you have, and you know them very clear, and that's what you have to do. And that's the idea, okay? If you know what your goal is, and you know that the political world is an insulia, it's not the tachlis, so you can survive. If not, I agree with
you. Pinterest, no, you have to campaign. You have to make promises. You have to lead. You have to make decisions. Sometimes you have to break promises. You don't find it a struggle? You don't find it difficult?
You know, because you know what the tachlis is. Everybody knows what your tachlis is. You say it from day one. Okay, you say you're taking care of Eilam HaTorah. You say you're taking care of the Shindir Chilul Shabbos. There's no reason you have to do that. If the tachlis is being a politician, so you have to promise this guy one thing and the other guy another thing, and you can't stand it. But if you know what your tachlis is, you know who sent you, you know what you were sent for, a lot easier.
Last question. I already promised you many times it's the last question. Your son comes over to you, Reb Yitzchak, says, Daddy, I want to go into politics. I want to be a Knesset member too. How would you respond?
Try to use an easier life, but if he's going to decide, I can tell him no. But I would tell him to go do it. It's probably easier not to be here.
Rabbi Yitzchak Pinchas, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I appreciated your insight. You've convinced me in some things. Other things I still need to be convinced. But I'm looking forward to speaking to you again soon. And again, a lot of atzlacha, success going into the Knesset on Sunday. And hope you'll bring a lot of kavod shamayim and a lot of success for the people in Israel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have a very special guest here. We're speaking to Minister Ze'ev Elkin, a Knesset member. Minister Ze'ev Elkin is the Minister of Higher Education and Water Resources of the State of Israel. We're so happy to have you here with us. Minister Elkin, how are you?
Wonderful. Good evening here in Israel, and good night.
Good night here in Israel. You're a busy man. Thank you for taking some time to speak with us. We appreciate it. We're having a conversation today about being religious as a politician. Do you find difficulty to reconcile the two? Your religiousness, your frumkeit, your Yiddishkeit, and being a senior politician?
Totally not. For me, it's oppositely. The reason that I'm a politician, it's in some kind the same reasons that I made the tshuva and I became the religion Jew. It's a way to influence on the life in my country, in the land of Israel. And it was the same reason that I decided when I was a young student in former Soviet Union to learn Hebrew and to make a tshuva and to study Judaism. And for the same reason, here in Israel, I decided to change my career. I was a doctoral student at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem and the final stage of my PhD about Rav Sadia Gaon, and in the middle way of academic career, I teach at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem as a young lecturer for 10 years before I came to politics. And then I changed totally my life, and I came to politics because I looked for the possibility to influence on the future of the Jewish people, and the future of the Jewish people in some way is decided here in Israel, in the Knesset, in the Israeli government, in the cabinet for foreign affairs and defense.
Can I ask you a question? You had a fascinating life. You're still having it. You're just at the beginning. You're born to a secular family in Kharkov, Ukraine, and you decide to become a Baal Tshuva. Were you influenced by Sadia Gaon's Einu Motenu Uma Ela B'Torata? Our nation is only a nation with its Torah. But let's get in a second. And you've been a minister of absorption of Jerusalem affairs, of strategic affairs. You were in the foreign ministry, the vice minister. And now you're running an 11 billion shekel budget of Israelis' higher education and all of the water resources of Israel. How did you get here?
Exactly the same way. I almost believed that I need to be in the place that I can influence the situation to change it in the way that I believe. I did it in the former Soviet Union when I was only 18 years old, the second year of my academic studies of mathematics in Kharkov University. And then I continue my study in Hebrew. I began my Hebrew studying when I was a student in the college, the age of 15, in the undergraduate Jewish movement, because it was forbidden then in Soviet time. And I continue it in the time of Perestroika, in the time of Gorbachev in Soviet Union. And surprisingly, I find it myself through some months from the position of the student that his career is in mathematics and he studied Hebrew for fun as a Hebrew teacher and the head of the organization of Hebrew teachers in my city. I remember that in the summer of the year 89, when I was only 18 years old, we were only something like 30 students of Hebrew language in my city. 3 months later, I find it myself as the head of the organization of Hebrew teachers, and in our structure, learned Hebrew. It's unbelievable, but it was 3,000 Jews. Only some months, the situation totally changed because many of the Soviet Jews decided to make Aliyah and to go to Israel, and they decided to study Hebrew. And
is there a moment you could pin down to that you decided to become a Baal Tshuva and Shomer Torah Mitzvah?
Yeah, exactly at that time. And step by step, not immediately, but in this age, 18, 19, I made the Tshuva. And exactly in the way that then I feel that I need to do it because somebody need to do it, and all of the people that they leading the Jewish movement then in the former Soviet Union, they made Aliyah, and in the place that there are no men to be the men. I did it at the age of 18. I did it in Israel when I made Aliyah and come to Israel, established some new organization in the field of absorption when I was very young student at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Then I come to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem with new idea of establishing a new center for Jewish studies in Russian language. And through some years, it became one of the largest centers in the Faculty of Humanities of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Then the same was in place. I did what I believed is right. And I continue in my political career step by step.
Minister Elkin, if I may jump back to present day, you chose to be part of a non-religious party, a general party, the Likud, which is a traditional base, but it's definitely not defined as a religious party. Why did you choose to do it that way?
Because I'm believing that the way to influence on the life in Israel in the direction that I think it's right, and I think it's right as a religion man, is much more useful through the party like Likud. Because when they are part of the religious party, you always been to be in the corner of somebody. It's a sectorial party. But when you are in Likud, you are in the largest party of the State of Israel now. And you can influence on many, many things. And all things that I'm doing as a religious Jew. I can bring you even example from the last days. You mentioned that I'm the Minister of Water Resources now in Israel. This week, I was responsible for finishing of the process, very big project of my ministry, of connection of Israeli national water system to the water system of the Jewish settlements in Samaria. It's a very, very special feeling. We are now in Israel, in last month, we are speaking a lot about Ribonut, the Israeli sovereignty in Judea and Samaria. But the real Ribonut, the real sovereignty...
The deal of the century,
connect,
as they call it here.
Yeah, it's to connect the people that they are living in Samaria to the national water system and to bring them to be in the same situation like all of the Israeli citizens. It's only one example that you can to implement.
You're saying you could have more influence on
your ideology in every place. I want to say to tell you a very interesting story that I remember when I began my political career. It was my first term in the Knesset, something like 15 years ago. I was then with some people in the meeting with the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. And at that time, he was still not the elected Prime Minister. He replaced it, Ariel Sharon, when Ariel Sharon was not able to continue to lead the country. And he told us very interesting things. He seated some people with them, and he told, you cannot imagine what kind of responsibility is to be the Prime Minister of this State of Israel. In all of the places that I was in them in the past, he was the mayor of Jerusalem, he was a minister of the health, and he was a minister of the industry, of the economy, in a different position. Always there was somebody that I came to speak with them, and I can phone them and to ask to speak with them and to ask from him the help and so on and so on. And when I became the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, the only thing that I can see is a picture of myself near me. I cannot phone to anyone. And in this time, I thought for myself, this is exactly the difference between secular Jew and religion Jew. Because for religion Jew, every time there is somebody that you can to speak with them, the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And one of the problems of secular leader of the country is that when he's asking himself, is him I can speak, it's only the picture of himself. With religion Jew and with religion politician, it's always different.
Thank you for sharing that interesting story. I want to ask you a question. So we interviewed a few other religious politicians, some of them from a religious Haredi party, and they'll say, you know, you need to have, not only to be talking to Hashem, you need to be talking to rabbinic authorities. You know, the religious parties get guidance and advice from rabbinic authorities. How do you respond to that? Who do you get when there are questions? Are there questions that you decide with consultation with rabbis, or you make all the decisions on your own?
At the end, I'm making my decision by myself, because it's my responsibility for the people who voted for me, and my responsibility for the Kadosh Baruch Hu for what I did. But of course, there are some rabbis that I studied from them. For 5 years, I studied in the Har Etzion Yeshiva. It's Yeshiva of Rabbi Lichtenstein and Rabbi Mital Zichron Av Livracha. And there are some rabbis, they were my teachers, and I am very respected them. And sometimes I'm coming to speak with them, and they are phoning me to speak with me about some different public things that, from their point of view, are very important, and they're asking for me to do something in this direction. And there are many rabbis, and they are, I'm in very deep connections with them. By the way, from different spectrum, Haredic rabbis and religion Zionist rabbis from different groups, and my personal teachers that I studied with them in the yeshiva, the cult. But at the end, in my from my point of view, and the rabbi cannot decide it for you because he cannot knew the facts that and understand them. Rabbis, they are not politicians. Then you can ask advice from the rabbi and try to speak with him about the situation and to describe him, but still the responsibility is your responsibility.
So, okay, so that's going to be a topic of very strong debate. Some are going to say that everything is a, you know, a question of Jewish law, of halacha, of especially things that have to do with the land of Israel and the major decisions that are made. Do you have examples of stories or moments where you had to ask questions that you had on a question, a halachic question in terms of a vote that you weren't sure about or a decision you had to make that you weren't sure and you consulted?
Yeah, for example, one of my positions in the past was the deputy foreign minister. And, you know, the foreign minister then was the prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And the meaning I was the only one of the deputy foreign minister, it means that I was responsible for leading of all of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at the time for 1 year. And kind of the, something like the acting minister. And in this capacity, you need to meet a lot of people that are coming to Israel, all of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and to meet, of course, all of the Deputy Foreign Ministers again, and so on, and so on, and so on. And, of course, a lot of the interviews in the media. And some months after I was appointed, we come to the time of 3 weeks, Ben Amtseri, and I ask the rabbi what I need to do, because I need to go to some international visits, and if my look will be like usually is in Ben Amtseri, it's not, the people will not understand what it means, and it means that I'm not respecting them as a representative of the state of Israel. And the rabbis that I speak with them bring to me to some advices, what I can do it, what I can do it, and so on and so on and so on.
Did you shave? Did you get a haircut? You did not get a haircut?
It depends. For some days, yes, and some days, no. It depends to what exactly the date, yes, and after this, no. And by the way, he told me something interesting that I expected it, and it was right. He told me, only because you are responsible for foreign affairs, you can't do it, but you can do it. But when you became again the politicians who will be responsible to speak only with Israeli public, it's opposite. You need, because it's even good that in the TV, Israeli TV, every people will see you and understand that this is a special period of Ben Amtseri. And I'm going with this advice that the kulot that I received from him for the time that I was deputy foreign minister, I stopped them 3 years after when I became again the responsible for different position as the head of the committee of the Knesset for Foreign Affairs and Defense.
So basically you're saying that this year you're going to grow a beard for the Ben Amtseri, since you're only working with Israelis with a higher education and the water resources. You said, so you chose to go to a general party. Do you think that all religious Jews should work within the framework, or you think it was a choice for you, but you believe that there should be religious parties that fight for their own agendas?
It's the decision of the politicians and, of course, of the voters, of the people, what they prefer. I'm believing that is the way to influence much more than to be the part of the religion party. But by the way, I'm not alone. There are some religion politicians in Likud, and there are some traditionals, people who studied in religion and received religion education, but now they are not totally religion, but they are traditional people. And of course, today in my party, there are many members of the party and activists that they are coming from religious communities. It's the kind of the change of the DNA of the party that we succeeded to change it in last years. And there are many, many religion people now that they are very active people and very important activists of the Likud party. And then I'm not feeling alone in this situation. In the last election, I think the majority, for example, of the religion Zionist community voted for Likud and not for the sectoral party.
You're known to be one of the closest ministers to Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Is Bibi Netanyahu's relationship with the religious Jews and religious parties, is it out of political necessity or is it ideological?
I think, first of all, it's ideological, because all of us, the part of a kind of the, we told it in the last, some last elections, the gush, the bloc of the right parties. And it's very, very a natural platform for cooperation between Likud and the religious parties, of different kinds of religion parties, because all of us...
The way I asked the other interviewees, is it Ahava Shetluya B'davar or Ahava She'ena Tluya B'davar?
I thought that it's very, very natural to cooperate for us. And we did it many, many times after many elections, because all of us were believing in the land of Israel, in the importance of Jewish identity of the state of Israel. That this idea is not so obvious for the leftist parties in Israel, and so on and so on and so on. Then we have difference, of course, with religious parties, but there is a kind of the mutual basic for all of us, then it's right that we cooperated, that we are in cooperation now, and we will be cooperating.
Also, you're known to have been to some of the many meetings between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Vladimir Putin, and very often you're translating between Putin and Netanyahu. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
It's a very special experience. For the last 10 years, when Netanyahu returned to position of the prime minister from 2009, it's even 11 years, I participated almost in all of the meetings between him and President Putin, and I was responsible for translation. Even once...
You know, we should call you... Minister Chutzpita Meturgaman, okay.
And when we were in one of our very important short trips to Russia, in the security matters, usually in last years, that they are connecting to Syria, when we were back on the plane to Israel, the prime minister asked me how I can be sure that you are translating me correctly for all of these years to Putin. And I told him that, of course, there are some other people...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand it. Bibi Netanyahu asked you how could he be sure that you translated what correctly?
I translated Netanyahu to Putin, and Netanyahu asked me how he, Netanyahu, can be sure that I'm translating him correctly to Putin. And I told him two answers. The first of all was that Putin has his own translator who is responsible for translating of Putin. And I asked Netanyahu, it was sometimes that he corrected me. He told me never. And I asked him, is there ever sometimes that I corrected him? He told me many times. I told him, you can see. And then the second answer was, if the results are good of your relations with Putin for all of these years, he told me they are wonderful. I told him, it doesn't matter if I'm translating you correctly or not. It's matter what is the result.
So again, I know you can't tell us what happens in that meeting, but I'm sure you're sitting there with
sometimes,
maps open.
Sometimes probably I will write the book, but it's not the time.
It's not the time. But there's nothing in those meetings that you felt like I need to ask a rabbi what to do, or again, if you're a translator, you have to translate whatever is being said. But when it comes to cabinet votes, decisions to go to war, decisions you're a member of the security cabinet of Israel, decisions whether to attack, not to strike, whether to strike, to authorize, to authorize a pula. You never felt like you feel like I need to ask one of my Rosh Yeshiva in Har Etzion.
I'm not sort of calling to my Rosh Yeshiva in this situation because I cannot share with him the facts, and without understanding the facts and the field of security, he cannot bring me to answer and to advise. But what I studied from my rabbis in Yeshiva Har Etzion to understand what huge responsibility is on my in this kind of decision. And it's very, very personal even. I cannot forget, for example, in my first term in the Knesset, when I wasn't a member of the security cabinet, I was only the member of the governmental coalition in 2006. In the time of the Second Lebanon War, in the time of the war, when I voted for the government every week, I knew that my brother is inside in Lebanon. He's one of the fighters. And I understand that the result of my decision of supporting of the government is the responsibility of me on the life of my brother. Before and many, many other Israelis for their fathers and brothers and their families. And it's very special and very hard feeling of responsibility. When I was the chair for the Committee of Foreign Affairs and Defense in the time of the last operation in Gaza to Kitan in 2014, again, I decided as a chair of the committee that I and the other members of committee need to go to all of the shiva of all of the parents who lost their sons in the war. And they asked me, why you decided this? It's very hard to go. There was something like 70 families and simultaneously, because it was it's the time of the war operation, and to go to everyone in different parts of Israel. I told, when we are deciding as the members of the Committee of Foreign Affairs and Defense to support it, not support, to approve it, not to approve this or other decision of the government in the time of the water operation, we need to be able to meet the families and to take the responsibility of losing of the lives of their sons. You need to understand it. You cannot vote without the understanding of the responsibility.
Listen, is it fair to say that we never had so many religious Jews in power, both in Israel and outside of it? In Israel, besides for you, I think there are 11 religious from ministers in the government. There's a Haredi woman. There are multiple religious women who are ministers in the government. The next ambassador to the UK, Tzipi Chotaveli, is also a religious woman. The attorney general is religious. The head of the Mossad is religious. The former head of the police is religious. In the White House, You have not one, not two, and not three people, and the American ambassador to Israel, who are all went to yeshiva, know how to learn that.
And also,
I just want to conclude. You know, even you, you know, when you came to the UN a few years ago and you called me up, you wanted to find a minyan you wouldn't miss, a mincha maariv, you're saying Kaddish for your mother. You ran in between to come say Kaddish to daven for the yomid. I don't think that there was ever a time in the last 2,000 years where there's so many religious Jews who were in power. Are we, you know, we look at ourselves as the minority, as the victim. But do you think the religious Jews are rising up to our responsibility at this point?
I can't explain why it's happened for some reasons. Some of them are connected for kind of the feeling of responsibility for religious people, for the future of the country, and they are very active people usually. And then it's, of course, for this reason they are coming to politics or to other important positions trying to change the life in Israel. But the other reason, it's very interesting, is demographical reason. Now the state of Israel is the process of the demographical change, very, very impressive demographic, huge demographical change. In the future, generation of Israelis, the religions will be the majority of the Jewish population in Israel. It's not the situation now. Now it's totally opposite. But when we are looking at our school education for the 6 years old children or 7, you can see that the majority of the Jewish sector in Israel will be religious people. Then
Are we ready to be the majority? Are we ready to be the majority? You know, it's easy when you're the...
Yes, yes. Yeah, this is again the understanding and the explanation why I decided to be the one of the leaders of the mutual party, not sectorial party, only of religion people. Because if in the past the responsibility of the religion politicians was to be responsible only for religious community, today the responsibility of religion politicians is to lead the Am Yisrael, the people of Israel, in the state of Israel.
Minister Elkin, thank you for everything you do. Thank you for sharing your wonderful time with us. Wonderful. Thank you for sharing your time, and we had a wonderful time speaking to you. A lot of atzlacha, all the best, and good Shabbos.
Thank you very much. Good Shabbos.
We have on the phone with us a very special guest today, Mr. Eli Groner. Eli Groner was the Director General of the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office from 2015 to 2018. Right now he's working at Koch Industries. He worked for McKinsey, has vast professional and personal experience, and we're very excited to have you on the phone with us. Mr. Groner, Shalom Aleichem, how are you?
Aleichem Shalom, pleasure to be here, Rabbi Goldschmidt.
First of all, how are you doing? Is it more relaxed in the private sector than it was working for a prime minister?
Everything is more relaxed than working in the prime minister's office. I am very, very busy, thank God. There's a lot of exciting, disruptive technologies to invest in Israel, but nothing can really compare to the pace of the prime minister's office.
Okay, that's excellent. Before you make a pitch about the investments in the technology sector, I would love to talk to you really about our conversation today is about being from in politics. So first of all, do you mind giving our listeners your personal background? Where did you come from? What's your family background? Where did you go to yeshiva and et cetera?
So very briefly, thumbnail version, and I can't pretend to be a rabbinic authority in any way, shape, or form. I'm a mainstream, observant, religious Zionist. Grew up in upstate New York, in Binghamton, New York. Moved to Israel with my family in the middle of high school when it became very clear that there wasn't much of a Jewish life or Jewish education, I should say, for high school and above. Went to a Yeshiva Bnei Akiva high school, finished off my high school at Yeshiva Bnei Akiva high school in Israel called Or Etzion. Went to the first year of the first Mechina program in Israel, Bnei David and Eli. And after that, was in the Army, and then undergraduate Bar-Ilan University, and the professional career you described earlier.
And if I'm not mistaken, your father was a rabbi, is a rabbi? Once a rabbi,
yes,
always
yes, yes.
a rabbi.
So my father, well, you know, once you get smicha, you say it sticks with you. But my father was a community rabbi in Binghamton, New York for 14 years. He was the rabbi of the only Orthodox synagogue in Binghamton.
Okay, so let's jump straight to, you know, you went back to America, you got your MBA, you worked for Lehman Brothers, Olav Shalom, and for other places. Tell me, how did you get into politics?
Great question. So, listen, growing up the son of a rabbi, growing up in a Zionist household, the sense of sort of community service and contribution to the strengthening of the Jewish people is always very important to me. So the idea of public service for the state of Israel always had appeal. However, I only wanted to transition to the public sector if I could get a position where I felt I had enough meaningful impact to justify leaving behind what I had in the private sector. And that opportunity presented itself in 2011 when I was appointed by the cabinet at the suggestion of the then finance minister, Yuval Steinitz, to be Israel's economic attaché to Washington. So that was my first foray into the public sector. It was a diplomatic role, basically Israel's senior most financial diplomat responsible for all government-to-government economic relations between Israel and the U.S. I really, really enjoyed that role, and every day of it was a blessing, and felt that there was great opportunity to have impact and contribute meaningfully to the economic stability of the Jewish state. And then when I got back to Israel, met with I was actually planning on going back into transitioning back into the private sector then. But Prime Minister Netanyahu was aware of a couple of policy moves that I was able to engineer in Washington. And we were introduced, and this was just before they were going to elections. This was about, you know, 5 or 6 elections ago. This was in November 2014. And the Prime Minister and I were in regular contact. And then after he won the election in March 2015, he asked me to take on the role as Director General.
So,
my 3.5 years in government turned into 7.
This is one of the most important trust positions that the Prime Minister makes. And my first question to you off the bat, when it comes to convergence between being from and being in the high echelons of power, Prime Minister Netanyahu needs you around the clock. What happens on Friday afternoon? You want to go back to your 5 kids at home and sing Shalom Aleichem, Prime Minister Netanyahu, needs something from you. So how does that work? How does Shmir Shabbos work working for the Prime Minister?
Very simple. We should all live to be 120, but when you go to Beit Din Shalmala, is Prime Minister Netanyahu going to ask me questions, or is Ribono Shel Olam going to ask me questions? And I have to say that Prime Minister Netanyahu was very respectful, the same way I think most reasonable people would be respectful as long as they see that you take things seriously. So I made it very, very clear very, very early that Shabbat, for example, is completely non-negotiable. And if you demonstrate that you're very, very strict about these things, then people in general have a lot of respect for it. But it is important to share that, you know, because so much of what's done is by definition holy work, then you do have that sort of constant question as to, wait a second, what genuinely justifies being a Chalal Shabbos? Now, in my opinion, it's very, 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 very little. But it's important to bear in mind that when you're running the Jewish country, so there's a lot of things that can't be outsourced. And that brings tremendous, tremendous complexity to halacha for the halakhic world that did not exist for a few thousand years. And these are things that contemporary halakhic leadership really needs to grapple with. And this is where we really need sort of the rabbinic leaders and the post-king to give us guidance and direction. These are the things, in my view, that religious Zionism in Israel struggles with the most.
So can you give me examples, practical examples of questions that you had regarding both Shabbos and other things during the time you served as the director general?
I'll start broadly with sort of an example of something of an issue we just described, but then I'll go into more practical things. So in a Jewish country with all sorts of security requirements in place, you know, the electricity needs to run. Power plants need to run. Who runs those power plants? You're a Rav, not me. So if there's certain things that need to be done in Israel, and sort of the power has to be going on 24/7, who runs the power plants? Who runs the telephone system? Or we had a big, big debate about, you know, there's a lot of international, multinational companies in Israel, and, you know, they won't tolerate work days that are 6 days a week. So what do you do when a company like Intel, which is certainly one of the biggest employers in Israel, one of the biggest companies in the world. So for them, you know, all their plants around the world run 24/7, 365. I'm talking about the plants where they manufacture the chips, the embedded chips that go into all sorts of machines, Intel inside. Now, in Israel, they understand that Yom Kippur, we have to be closed. No one's going to work on Yom Kippur. It's a compromise, but they say, you know, to have sort of the Jewish minds in Israel working at the Intel plant, we're willing to shut the plant down for one day a year. But if you're going to shut their plants down one day a week, these are plants that are open 24/7, 365, they're not going to open up any plants here. So what's the implication for all the employment here? What's the implication for all those employees? So how do you navigate policy in a world like that, where you have religious parties that say working on Shabbos is absolutely not allowed no matter what, versus letting people that are willing to work on Shabbos and don't mind working on Shabbos, in order to have employment for everyone? So these are complicated, complicated, complex policy issues. And I mean, that's one example of many, many that we constantly have to think about. And people running a Jewish country need to think about how do you design laws and policies around these things. And quite frankly, rabbinic leadership needs to think about, you know, how do you work? How do you operate in a country where the buck stops here? There are many, many things where you can't outsource it. You can't have the Shabbos goy do it, right? You just can't do it when the entire country is Jewish.
Ellie, these are very important questions. Reb Lazer de Waldenberg wrote a book about running a country according, you know, within Jewish law. It's not a known work of his that people know as much as they should. But I want to focus on a role the role you had. So, for example, you know, when you have to evaluate if there's a report coming in from the head of the Shin Bet or the head of the Mossad, does the prime minister want to review that with you? Is that every single time a report comes in, is that a question of pikuach nefesh? Every single time there's a discussion in the cabinet about the decision to be made about regarding Iran, is that pikuach nefesh? So, I mean, every time there's, you know, isn't pikuach nefesh a constant decision in Israel?
On security issues, obviously, there's many kikot. Basically, it's all military work, all ongoing military work, the Shabak work, Mossad work, and of course, IDF work is allowed on Shabbat, and that has to do with sort of operational things, and exercises and practices are not allowed. Now, most of that stuff is the strategic stuff. You're talking about a cabinet decision to do something dramatic. Those are all very, very strategic, are planned out heavily ahead of time, and there's no need to schedule one of those cabinet meetings dafka on Shabbat. There were many times we had cabinet meetings on Saturday night. There were cabinet meetings that went on Friday up until Shabbat. The prime minister conducted many security meetings on Shabbat, but my view was always, do I need to participate? Is my participation genuinely required to justify sort of pikuach nefesh? And the answer 99%+ of the time was that no, my role was much more of a strategic role. And therefore, I made it very, very clear that anything that has to do with sort of day-to-day security operations, I don't have the expertise. And there are other people that would make my participation not necessary. So I wouldn't participate in those. And by the way, to be very honest, because I value my time, I didn't participate in those on Sunday through Friday either, right? You want to only participate in meetings where you have real value add and where there's real strategic benefit. You don't need two people in the meeting that know the exact same things. But yes, the issue about Chavez often came up. I was responsible for, you know, just one of the responsibilities in the role, in the job is approving flights for people, et cetera, and for a subordinate, for people that, for whom I was their supervisor. I remember one incident where a very senior person in the prime minister's office, sufficiently senior that he was accompanying the prime minister on a trip to London, a trip I did not go on. Prime minister asked him to stay an extra day to have a meeting with someone on that meeting took place on a Friday. So he needed to return to Israel on Shabbos on Saturday. But because he was training, because flights have to be approved by the superior or whatever, so I had to approve the flight. So he calls me up and says, Ellie, listen, Prime Minister asked me to stay for this meeting with this security official and senior security official in the UK. So I need to come back on Shabbat. I need to get a flight back on Shabbat. So first thing I did was I called up my rabbi and said, listen,
who's your rabbi?
I called up Rav Eli Sadan. He's the head of the Mosdot HaTorahim for Bnei David and Eli. And he was the head of the Mechina that I went to, and he's the head of the Yeshiva Gvoah. And my two oldest sons have gone there as well, and it's really one of the finest institutions in Israel, certainly religious institution. So I called him up, and his response to me was, listen, Eli, very, very hard to justify this. If, however, because I told him who the person was, and he said, listen, this is a person who's very, very senior. You're relatively new in your position. So if you think for the sake of your ability to maintain your relationship with him is going to be so important that you have, under that auspices, you could have the sort of, you can make the decision to approve it, but otherwise there's no justification. So I said, thank you very much, Rabbi. In that case, the answer is no. And I called him up and I said, I'm not approving your trip back. I understand that you had to have a meeting on Shabbat. Prime Minister asked you. I understand there was a security-oriented meeting. So that doesn't give you carte blanche to be Mechal Shabbos beyond that. And you can do whatever you want on your own time, but I'm certainly not authorizing you flying back to Israel on Shabbos. And that was it. And people...
I love it. So you sent him to get some challenge in Hendon. You should have sent him to Golden Green for Shabbos. You know, get him revered. Yeah. Then he would be really upset, you know?
It's more likely he was in the Marble Arch neighborhood, but yeah.
Okay.
St. John's would maybe.
That's interesting. Are there any other stories of that kind you would like to share? Of like any other moral or ethical questions you had as a firm person being the Director General of the Prime Minister's Office?
Too many to even think of, Rabbi Goldschmidt. It's a constant issue. And there's one thing that's important for your listeners in the exile to understand. And this is sort of, you asked me where I went to yeshiva. I told you in Eli and in Mechabde David. I will say this. And it was 30 years ago. And, we had the Sidrei Gemara and everything. And it was a seder similar to many, many yeshivot. I don't want to go into, everything I remember that I learned that year, but I will tell you the one single most important thing that I remember learning that year. And this is really when I had my aha moment on what religious Zionism is all about. Throughout Jewish history, there's always been a very, very clear distinction between Kodesh and Kol, right? There were certain things that were clearly Kodesh, study hall, things that had to do with, Siyat Mitzvot and whatnot. And then it was the Kol, the secular, the however it's translated, profane, different people translate it differently. And there was clear distinction
between Kodesh
and Kol.
The mundane, correct.
Exactly.
Kol means mundane.
I prefer to think about it as general, right? In Israel, by the way, we think about it as klali, but I won't get into that discussion now.
Okay.
One of the things, my big sort of realization when I was in Eli was that in the modern, sovereign, Jewish nation state in the ancient land of Israel, right, in Eretz Yisrael, the distinction between Kodesh and Chol is much more blurred. Because yes, being in the study halls and the base measures, that's Kodesh. But guess what? Strengthening the security of the Jewish state is also Kodesh. And strengthening the judicial system of the Jewish state is also Kodesh. And strengthening the police force in the Jewish state is also Kodesh, right? Our Torah says, Shofting the Shotrim, right? So it's not just learning Torah that's Kodesh. And when you live in a society, and for the first time in 2,000 years, right, being a policeman in Russia or the U.S. or wherever might not be holy work, but if you're helping to strengthen the Jewish state in any way, shape, or form, in academia, in our economy, in our judicial system, anywhere, that becomes holy work. And that gives a whole new outlook on what's Dochet Shabbat, what's not Dochet Shabbat, what's Dochet Tfilah, what's not Dochet Tfilah. My whole approach changed around that. And so thinking about that, and then you sort of magnify that by actually doing public service in Israel, which is really, really advancing the policies of the sovereign Jewish nation state and aspiring to do things that, you know, fulfill the vision of being a Mamlechet Kohanim and Goy Kadosh. Those are things that are, I think, every religious Zionist who takes his religion seriously should be struggling with these things on a daily basis and making those sort of real-time calculi. So did I have to deal with these things all the time? But the lens was always what I just described to you right now.
For the sake of this podcast, you're bringing the religious Zionist perspective, but we also had a fascinating conversation with incoming Knesset member Yitzhak Pindrus. And I was asking him about the relationship between a very, interesting relationship between the Haredim, the Haredi parties, especially, and Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Likud party, how it's become sort of an unusual, very close alliance, and on the meaning for it. How do you view that alliance?
You say Haredi parties, there are multiple Haredi parties.
Could I repeat the question? One second. Yeah. Okay,
sure.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do you want to repeat the question?
I added to him, is it the relationship between Netanyahu and the Haredi parties? Is it Ahavat Luya B'davar or Ahavat She'ina Tluya B'davar? So Batel Davar B'Teila Ahava. That was the way I posed the question to him. So.
Well, he's a politician, so he's a politician, so he has to give the politically correct answer, the lo mubana mila, right? That he has to really give the politically correct answer. That is the correct answer from a political perspective. But of course, it's Ahavat Shekliya B'davar, right? There's no question about it. And anyone who says otherwise is fooling your listeners, and I know no one would ever be able to fool your listeners. But the point is that the relationship between the politicians is political. Right. And the Haredi parties, and I distinguish between Shas and Aguda, right, because Shas's representatives are in the Haredi stream, but many of their voters are not at all Haredi. They just identify with the Sephardic background, etc., but many of them are just traditional Sephardim. There is distinction between that and the religious Zionists. And I think it's important to bear in mind that, you know, the religious Zionists who view the vision of Israel being a Mamlechet Kohanim and a Goy Kadosh and being an Or LaGoyim, really, I think Netanyahu historically has struggled with them more than he has with the Haredim, where it's been much more of a sort of politically driven give and take and not an ideologically given driven give and take. So
yeah, the religious Zionists are at the government and the Haredim are sitting up front.
Yeah, the religious Zionists take many of these sort of policy things very, very seriously. The Haredi parties, by the way, should be very clear. The head of the Haredi party, the main primary Haredi party, right, Aguda, right, the head, Litzman, he's very conflicted on whether he's even allowed to be a minister in the government because he doesn't want to give lechet yad la medinat tzionit, right? There's a real, real challenge there. And they have to do all sorts of backflips and going through hoops and gymnastics so that he could really be, he's not really a minister. He's a deputy minister, but he reports to Netanyahu.
He's a minister. He's a minister.
Right, but he didn't want to be a minister. They compromised, whereas the religious Zionists view positions of authority in the government as true shlichut, and they view sitting in the security cabinet as true shlichut. But listen, for religious Zionists, when we say every week in shul the bracha l'mdina, we believe that, and we talk about Israel being a chalka b'gula, we really mean it. Right, we really, really mean it, and so that manifests itself in what do we do to strengthen the state of Israel. And by the way, I'm talking as someone who is not a member of the Religious Zionist Party, just as a religious Zionist, but I have never had any sort of formal alliance with the Religious Zionist Party.
Ellie, I want to turn a little bit to a historical perspective. Tell me, what are you most proud of your years in service?
Just the policy we were able to implement, particularly in a time of populism. You know, I love, there's an old story, I have no idea if it started as a Jewish story or not, but I like the example of a person gets up to the Beit Din Shamala, and God says to him, you know, where are your scars? And the guy says, oh God, I was able to get through everything with, you know, without ever having to really have a big machlokes with anyone. Right? I was able to go through with no regret. And God looks at him and says, you had nothing worth fighting for. So my point is that policy is easy when everyone is aligned. Policy is really, 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 really hard when there's a lot of opposition. And in the current sort of age of populism, public policy is very, very challenging. So in order for us to sort of develop Israel's offshore energy market, we came up with tremendous populism, and we passed legislation that basically made illegal building, it basically eliminated 50% of illegal construction across Israel. That was really, really hard to do. There are a lot of interest groups that were very sort of interested in that. And there were probably 7 or 8 major pieces of legislation. We passed a piece of legislation, which I won't go into the details here, but it basically constrains the amount that the government is able to spend. So it reduces the budget deficit. I mean, these are things that were very, very, I met up with a lot of opposition over anything I did that was worthwhile. And so when I look back on the 3.5 years and I look at the economic policy and the domestic policy that we were able to change, we were able to institutionalize, the OECD put out a report saying that no one did more to deregulate their markets between 2013 and 2018 than Israel. And they wrote a case study on us, and the World Economic Forum said the same thing. I mean, these were many, many structural changes that were very, very, very difficult to do. And I have to say, I had major, major arguments with almost every single minister, with many lobbying groups, with many interest groups. But I always was, sort of, my North Star was always what's in the best interest So the lobbying group that I was most worried about were the citizens of Israel. And that's sort of what drove me across all the policy decisions. And that's what I have that's what I take the most satisfaction in.
Now tell me, it's fascinating. If you had a disagreement of opinion with your boss, how did you share it and how did you communicate it?
With tremendous respect. With a tremendous respect for the position of the prime minister, and respecting that he always had final say, and trying very much to encourage him to do the right thing. So I recognize that there were a lot of policy decisions, right? That there was this horrible agreement with the Israel Electric Company Union that I just wouldn't let it go through. But finally, and I know the prime minister agreed with me, but there was overwhelming pressure put on him. So I always respected his final decision, but I always tried to make it I tried to make him feel as guilty as possible about making decisions that I thought and he thought, and I knew that he thought were wrong. But in the end, politicians make decisions. They have political calculus that they need to incorporate. And so I was always very respectful of that. But yes, for many, many areas that we disagreed on, but
were you able to change his mind about a few decisions?
Yes. The answer is yes. I don't know if it's fair to go into which ones, why. I don't know if it's the time or the place, but the answer is yes.
And so basically telling this story about coming up to Shamayim with scars, you don't think politics is dirty. You don't think it's an inappropriate place. You think that there's absolutely no contradiction being from and being in the highest echelons of politics. How soon after Shabbat, after Abdullah, would you get a call from the prime minister's office? How many minutes after Abdullah?
All the time. Sometimes 5 seconds. But the point is this. Politics, you're describing politics the way it is, and it's almost universal. But my vision is always about what it could be. So if people know that you're Jewish, forget whether you're wearing a yarmulke or not, but if people know that you're Jewish, then there are certain expectations, certain types of behavior. And I always sort of, I try to find the right balance between the right levels of conviction and humility to do the right thing and to convey why we're doing the right thing, to be firm when necessary, but always be respectful. And it's not just with the prime minister, it's not just managing up, but it's also managing down. And that's how you get credibility with other politicians, right? So you always, if you do your job with fidelity to your ideology, then you're always going to have disagreements with people. And as long as people know that those disagreements are l'shem shemayim, then people are respectful. If you look at, you're the rabbi, but if you look at Jewish history throughout the Gemara, all the Zugos, so there were always people, there's Beit Hillel and Shammai, there's Rabbi, there's Abaye, there's always debate. But as long as, and sometimes
Kol machlokas shi l'shem shemayim sof l'iskayin.
Exactly. So in politics, most machlokot are not l'shem shemayim, but they're rather, if I belong to this person's camp, then I have to adopt this policy. And if I belong to that person's camp, I have to adopt that policy. What I try to convey, and by actions, not by words, but I try to convey to everybody who I interacted with, whether it was the senior most bureaucrats at Kibim or the ministers, was that when I disagreed with them, it was always out of respect, but always out of great conviction that I was doing something because it was the right thing to do. And that doesn't mean you don't compromise in negotiations, right? When you're negotiating a national federal budget with 380 billion shekels, you're going to have compromises. So it's not about negotiating weakly or not being willing to compromise, but it's about being very clear on what things are having people understand why you're taking a stance for the things you're taking a stance on, and also be willing to lose, right? When I came into the position in the beginning, so a couple of my aides would say to me, no, don't take that fight. Don't avoid that battle because you're just going to lose it. And my response to them was, no. I'd rather lose it than not fight it. And I know we're going to lose this one, but I want it to be very clear that we're taking a stance on this. And I was never worried about the quote-unquote shame of losing a policy battle. I wanted it to be very clear what I stood for and why.
So Sefer Melachim, after mentioning lives of different kings, it says Vayas Hara Beinei Hashem or Vayas Atov Beinei Hashem. How is Bibi Netanyahu going to remember it in Jewish history?
I'm going to dodge that question. That's not for me to say. I'm not going to answer that question. Sorry.
I want to ask you another question. There's a biography that was recently written about Prime Minister Netanyahu, and it says that Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he chooses the closest people to him, he prefers to choose from English-speaking American Jews who made Aliyah. And they bring a few examples, and you are one of them. Why do you think it is that way? Why does he feel most comfortable with from American Jews who make Aliyah to work for him and to carry out his agenda?
I don't believe that. So I don't think that is necessarily true. Right. So you're accepting a premise which I'm not sure I agree with.
No,
Prime Minister Netanyahu. Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu has, over the years, has had many, many advisors from many, many walks of life. And there has been a small percentage, a relatively very small percentage, that fit the profile that you described. I can tell you that my background maybe checks those boxes, but my role, I mean, I was the first person from that profile in the role I was in, right? And to be quite honest, the one area that I had the least activity in was in sort of U.S.-Israel affairs, right? That space is very, it's canvassed well, and there's other people dealing with it. I wouldn't even accompany Netanyahu on half his trips to the U.S. So he certainly didn't pick me because I grew up in the United States or because I speak English, right? That had very, very little to do with my role. So I think, you know, it's easy to make statements by cherry-picking a couple of data points and saying, ah, this is a high-profile person with an Anglo background, and that's a high-profile person with an Anglo background. Therefore, Netanyahu must like these kind of people. When you're prime minister for 15 years, you're going to have a lot of aides and a lot of advisors and a lot of sort of people that you have been around. And yeah, some of them are, but guess what? There's probably 200,000 U.S. citizens in Israel, and some of those are bound to end up, just by virtue of probabilities, some of those are bound to end up working for a prime minister who has such an international focus to his role. But I wouldn't. I'm not sure I agree with the underlying premise of your question.
Is this conflict between projecting pride and how it balances with humility? On one hand, we say, how do you feel about that? When Bibi speaks, we're never going to let anyone destroy us. We're so strong. We're so powerful. On the other hand, there's some humility as a religious person, the understanding that we're in the hands of Hashem and it's not completely in our power. How do you,
Rabbi Goldschmidt, Gesher Tzar Me'od. Gesher Tzar Me'od. It is really, really hard to strike that balance. It is really, really, really hard to strike that balance. It's a constant battle. And, you know, I try to walk it every day, and God knows I failed many times, but you just have to find that right balance of going in that middle path of Gesher Tzar Me'od, right? Not to go too far onto one side and not to go too far to the other.
Ali, I want to ask you, do you think Israel is going to have a from prime minister one day?
Of course I do.
Within the next decade?
No, I don't think it will happen in the next decade.
But you think that's where we're heading
to? If you're asking me if in the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, yes. You know, if we continue to be, the Jewish people in Israel are becoming increasingly connected to their Judaism. And the religious Zionists are increasingly becoming perceived as less a group that is focused on sort of niche budgets for their religious school system, and more people that are really interested in taking an active role in leading the country. And, I don't know if it'll be 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, but God willing, in our lifetime, it'll happen.
Ali Groner, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you giving us such a personal and detailed, interview. And I'm wishing you much success and lots of nachas from your kids. And if one of your kids tells you they want to be a politician, will you encourage or discourage that decision?
Depends what reasons. But I try to, as long as it's for the right reasons.
Mr. Groner, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
And hope to speak to you soon.